Christian Parenting. Aloha, friends. Welcome back to the podcast. And I think you're going to love today's conversation. I'm actually just asking myself how it took me so long to bring this topic to the podcast. This is a topic I'm passionate about. It is a topic that comes up pretty much every day in the Swanson household. My husband, you may know, is a doctor, and health and nutrition is super important to him. And if you happen to read my book, Boy Mom, which came out in 2019, I have a whole section in there about the importance of raising healthy kids. That book covers the things your sons need most from you, and one of them is a healthy foundation. Because as I say in that book, kids are not born knowing what is good for them and what is not. When they're real young, they eat what we give them. And then as they grow up, they eat what we allow them to have. And so we have quite a responsibility as parents to give our kids a healthy foundation for the best chance at them growing up to be healthy, and also to educate them and help them understand how to make good choices as they grow up. So again, I love this topic. I hope you do too, because I'd really like to bring more conversations here to the podcast about kids and nutrition and all the things we are opening up today. Now, today I'm super excited because I am bringing Katie Kimball on. Katie has had a kitchen stewardship blog for many years. She also has Kids Cook Real Food. She loves to talk about bringing kids into the kitchen. And today she's going to explain how that can help them make better health choices. So we talk about a lot. We kind of hang out talking about picky eaters. So if you've got one of those, I think this is going to be helpful. I throw some Q&As at her from things people sent in through my Instagram stories. And I think you're going to learn a lot and be encouraged and equipped to raise kids to be a little bit healthier, to handle those picky eaters, and to just make good choices as a family. So I'm really excited about this conversation. Now, before we jump right in, I want to make sure that you are on my weekly email list. I take such good care of my email people. I love to send them encouragement, helpful links and resources, favorite books, all those kinds of things. So if you're not on that list yet, please go over to monicaswanson.com/subscribe. And this spring, there's some really exciting things going on. You're not going to want to miss it. So hope you'll become a part of my email list. Now, I'll have a few final words to say at the end, but without further ado, let's jump in and talk to Katie about raising healthy kids. I think you're going to be encouraged. Katie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Monica.
I have been so looking forward to this. I've been like smiling all day, just like, oh my goodness, these topics are so good. I just can't wait. So before we jump in, will you give a quick introduction to just who you are, what you do, and even where you are?
Sure. I'm in Michigan and I'm a mom of four. They're currently 10, 13, 16, and 19. So a little bit in most of the phases except toddlerhood. And I'm a teacher by trade. So I started out life teaching third grade. And as soon as I had my first, I knew that I didn't want to split my brain between momming and teaching. That would not go well for me. And so I came home and we married pretty young. And so eventually when I ran the budget numbers after I even stopped teaching part-time, I was like, oh, that's red. That's not good. And so my journey online really started as an effort to like make a few thousand dollars a year. Like, because I thought, oh, I could sell Pampered Chef. I could like tutor, you know, babysit in the house. And I had this book idea that I'd been tumbling about in my head called Kitchen Stewardship. And just the idea of like, I was making a lot of mistakes in the kitchen as I was trying to transition away from like the Hamburger Helper family to more of a Whole Foods family. And I thought, I think other moms want this too, but it's tricky because we feel really pulled. Like I always had the image of this frazzle-haired mom, like with all her appendages pulled in opposite directions. And one was budget, time, nutrition, and then caring for the environment. And so for me, like this idea of kitchen stewardship is how are we able to be good stewards of all those gifts? Because those are all gifts from God. Yeah. But we let them stress us out instead of being grateful for them. And so that's where my initial foray online started. I did not know that writing a book was a really bad way to make money. And so luckily I started. Somebody told me, you should start a blog and see if anyone cares about your ideas. Like best, God bless this magazine editor who actually answered my email. I don't know why.
Wow.
I know. It's really random. And it completely changed the trajectory of our family because I started blogging and building an audience and loving it. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I just got like a little bit of money. You know, that first check from Google AdSense for like $3.76.
Oh, yeah.
I made some money online. And that has just grown from helping moms find their sanity and be good stewards in the kitchen to then shifting about 8 years ago to teaching kids to cook.
Yeah.
Because I realized so many moms said, Katie, I really want to get healthy, but it's extra hard because I'd never learned to cook. Like, yeah. I don't even know how to cook. Definitely. And I thought, we are going to have that same situation in 20 years when our kids grow up if we're not teaching them to cook. And we're not, because we're not comfortable in the kitchen. So I thought, moms need help. We've got to make sure the younger generation has the skills to feed themselves and nourish themselves. And so that's where Kids Cook Real Food started.
That is so cool. You have an important message. And I'm so passionate about your message. I was just telling you before we recorded, I don't know why I haven't talked more about this on the podcast. I'm like, everyone, hold on, because this is just the beginning. I really love that we get to talk about this. Let's just start with kids meals. We're going to get into kids cooking a little bit as well, but tell us, what is wrong with kids meals? How kids eat?
Boy, where do you even start? I mean, honestly, the first thing that's wrong with kids meals is that they exist. Like 100 years ago, children ate what adults ate. That we're right. We're all human beings.
Right.
So I think, you know, a kid's meal, a child's meal could be smaller portion size than adults. Absolutely. Sure. Maybe a little less spicy. Mm, right. Absolutely. Like there are some differences.
Cut it up smaller, maybe pieces.
Exactly. The fact that we're eating radically different food and that there's whole foods, that entire like groups of foods that are called kid food. And then somehow we're expecting the kids to grow out of that into their adult food. Wow. You know, we've got 30-year-olds who are still eating the chicken nuggets and the mac and cheese. And this is a significant problem for their nutritional status. So I think, I mean, the kids' meals are, they're just marketing to us. They're allowing, food marketers have convinced parents that they, you know, they want us to buy their products. Therefore, they're telling us that it's easy. It's fast. You can feed your kids what they want. You can avoid the battles and the power struggles and the fights. And unfortunately, I do think all of this really readily available kid-friendly convenience food has just made it easier for picky eaters to become pickier.
Yes.
Right? Like it's not what it, we parenting research actually shows that the style of parenting, the way parents eat, the parents like even level of depression cannot create a picky eater. The picky eater is created is inside the child's body. However, we can feed that picky eater.
Yes.
We can feed the picky eating tendencies and fuel it more by giving in and, and allowing the kids to eat what they want, which unfortunately is because it's so convenient. So we've got to change this whole definition and structure that kids' meals should even exist.
Okay, that's all so good. And yeah, I'd say we're enabling those picky eaters, right? And I know you have a lot more to say on that, but I feel like I should pause here because I think you're going to agree with me. We don't want anyone listening to feel condemned, judged. Like, this is a reality that I think we just haven't talked about enough in our culture. Most of us, I have been guilty of this. Like, this isn't something that if you realize as we're talking that you have been raising a picky eater or that you've been buying into kids' meals, no judgment. But let's talk about what we can do to change that. First, though, tell us what that's leading to. You have found all kinds, you have done your research. What happens when we do these kids' meals that are mostly, what do you say, beige and bland? And what does this lead to? What are the problems?
We're really closing down kids' palates. Because you're right. If we think about popular kid foods, chicken nuggets, mac and cheese, pizza, pancakes, waffles, french fries, they're really a pretty basic visual palate. They're generally fairly bland foods. They tend to be easy to chew, right? Hot dogs, sausages, chicken nuggets, they're kind of pre-chewed meat. And so we're closing down kids' palates by reducing the variety that they're exposed to, which is just going to be a snowball effect. The more we allow it to be closed down, the more it's going to be closed down, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So expanding the palate to a wider variety of foods is very important. We're closing down the nutritional options that our kids' bodies have to accept. We're probably creating, you know, gut dysbiosis in throwing off the beneficial microbes that are down there if we're not giving them, especially fruits and vegetables and maybe fermented foods. And really, we're interfering, I think, with the child's ability to build a good relationship with food. Wow. Because these highly processed foods, I mean, they've got the pizzazz of, if you think about, like, there are kids who are really drawn to, like, fire Cheetos and then the highly, highly seasoned stuff. Those are packed with MSG, which is short-circuiting their brain and telling them, eat more, this is amazing. Or we've got, you know, the really sort of bland palate basic foods. And both of those, especially, again, highly processed foods, lots of sugar, all that, it's really short-circuiting our kids' relationship with food. They don't even understand how to encounter new foods and how to be curious instead of fearful at the table. So that's, I mean, I think as parents, it's easy to look at a meal, that this meal is, I need to get nutrients in this meal, or I need to avoid a battle with this meal, whatever your motivation is. But we've got to look at parenting as that 18-year game. And when I, you know, when I launch a kid at 18 or whenever that is, I want them to have a good relationship with food. I want them to be able to encounter new foods and not be scared of them. And if we're constantly feeding the same nutrient deficient food, we're really sabotaging their ability to even do that.
Sure. That makes sense. And also the health consequences we've heard about. Maybe you want to share some of that, some of the findings on childhood diseases that didn't used to be childhood diseases, numbers, obesity in kids, all the things that we're finding and are finally coming out for all of us to learn from.
Yeah, we know that 1/3 of our teens are clinically depressed or anxious. And I know that may not feel like it has to do with food, but there are calming foods and then there are anxiety-inducing foods. And a lot of times, especially if we're eating like a low-fat, high-carb diet, that can generate a lot of anxiety in kids. So that's a really big deal. Absolutely. I want to say, I think it's 10% now of preschoolers are obese.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know the number is getting really, really big. And I think it's over 50% as well as of our teens. And we know that not all people who are overweight or obese are going to have health problems, but we also know that most people with chronic health problems are overweight or obese.
Yes.
So it's just one of those, you know, metrics where you go, it's not a good thing to just say that's okay.
Sure.
You know, we are seeing a lot of chronic diseases that, like you said, used to be only for adults down in children. They're having fatty liver disease, which used to be only like alcoholics.
Wow.
But teens and young adults are experiencing fatty liver disease. We're seeing, you know, type 1 diabetes used to be called juvenile diabetes. And type 2 diabetes was always and only later onset for adults.
Yes.
We're seeing quite a bit of type 2 diabetes now down with our kids, probably because we're not regulating blood sugar very well as a culture. The amount of sugar, I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics says children should have no more than 24 grams of sugar in a day. Now, that's low. 4 grams of sugar is a teaspoon. And if you look at just your average, pretty small size granola bar, you're going to see usually 9 to 12. So that could be one granola bar.
Half,
which you're not
sugar.
Even thinking of as like a dessert, so to speak,
right,
is possibly half of, you know, the allocated sugar.
Amazing.
Most kids are eating way, 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 way more than that.
Oh, yes.
And it's displacing the calorie, like, expense that they need for nutrient-dense foods.
Sure.
So we can argue, you know, and people will. It's, oh, sugar's not that bad, blah, blah, blah. You know what? When they're eating so much sugar that they're not hungry for broccoli and apples and hummus, then it's a problem.
It is. It is. And certainly leading to behavioral issues. Mm-hmm. Funny, my boys, as you know, have been homeschooled, but my oldest son went to school through first grade. And I remember his first grade teacher asked me one day, he said, what do you feed Josiah for breakfast? And I was like, well, most days, you know, bowl of cereal or eggs. And I was like, but sometimes we do, what was it? The waffles, the toaster waffles.
Oh, sure.
And he's like, I can tell the days he has syrup on his waffles because his behavior, and my Josiah is like the sweetest, most well-mannered kid. But his teacher was like, no more waffles with syrup because I can tell he is not, he talks too much. He interrupts. And it was, the teacher even related it back then. And I was like, oh my goodness. And we think of ourselves as a pretty healthy family, but even in first grade, we saw that connection. So I think that's interesting.
Wow. My daughter is 16 and she's, she won't listen to anything I say about food, but she figures it out on her own. And it's, she's good to go. So she just kind of this year, last year as a sophomore and a junior, has realized we do one day of cereal a week. And so for the rest of the family, it's cereal with whole milk. So there's fat and protein, but she's dairy free. She can't handle the dairy. And so almond milk has like no fat and no protein. So she was noticing on cereal days that by 10 a.m., she was getting hangry. She was getting unfocused and she did not like the way she felt. And so she's made a rule for herself as a teenager, protein at breakfast.
Okay.
And she's experimented enough that she knows if she can add like some sausage or some avocado protein or fat, that she feels so much better and gets through to lunch. Yeah.
Yes. And it's so great to really help kids begin to tune into that and develop their own awareness. And so before we get to that, because I do want to talk about kids as they grow up, but for those with young kids still in the house, still in this process of raising them, what do we need to do to raise the bar?
Oh, man. I mean, the earlier you can get kids involved in the kitchen, the better. Teaching your kids to cook is such a blessing for them because, again, they need these skills. As adults, they're going to eat 3 to 5 times a day, every day, the rest of their lives. And for me, I want my kids to have the ability to unlock that produce section with knife skills, to be able to make recipes that they enjoy and not feel like they have to rely on convenience foods just because they are ignorant. They don't know how to make food. Sure. So that's really important to me. But also if we think about, you know, we were just talking about picky eaters and you're right, like no blame, no shame, parents. Like the world has made it really, really, really hard to feed our kids well. So don't worry about what's in the rearview mirror. You know, just make a tiny change today, one small change. Right. But when we think about our picky eaters, they need that variety. They need exposure to foods. And a lot of times, whether this was intentional or not, usually it's unintentional, there's some stress at the table with picky eaters, right? The more kids say no to foods, the more parents are like, yeah, but, and we start to power struggle at the table. And so the table can feel like a stressful place.
It can.
For kids. And even if we do our best to make it unstressful, there's still a little bit of that bodily, that physical sense of like, or food goes on their plate and their brains say, somebody's going to make you eat that. You know, even if you've never said that, they just feel like they're going to be made to eat it. Being in the kitchen is this beautiful, safe place where no one feels like they have to eat. They know the goal is just to make the food. And so they're more able to get rid of some of that sense of fear or stress and encounter the food, make friends with their vegetables. Plus, physiologically, scientifically, they're getting kind of the sight, smells, sounds, touch, texture of food. And that can actually begin to help their palate be more ready to accept that food.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So actually getting them in the kitchen cooking is going to make them more likely to be open to trying more things.
Yep. For sure.
Okay. And how about before? Let's talk to the mom with toddlers, kids who aren't maybe helping in the kitchen much yet. What would you recommend just as far as what goes on their plate and how to respond when they don't want to eat something?
Well, everything that the parents are eating should go on the kid's plate.
Okay.
So when I talk to parents of picky eaters, one of the rules that I recommend is called a taster bite or an experience bite. And it means that we don't want to give a whole serving because people don't like food waste. And the whole serving can be like visually overwhelming to kids. Sure. And they're thinking, I got to eat all of this. So one bite. Best case scenario is they serve it themselves. Obviously, they need to be old enough to at least be able, you know, lift them up and reach in, whatever. But it's an experience bite. And so the phrase is, you don't have to eat this. And kids need to hear that over and over. I need you to have this on your plate because I want you to make friends with your food, but you don't have to eat this. And one of my favorite stories, this is from years and years ago. Another phrase that I teach parents to give to their kids is the phrase, it's not my favorite. Because, I mean, what pushes your buttons more as a mom who's just made, you know, spent 60 to 90 minutes making a dinner and the kid says, ew, gross. I don't like this. I don't want to eat it. Right. We're like, and so in our household, our kids are allowed to say, this is not my favorite.
That's so good.
Which is so just polite, not yes. button pushing at all.
Right.
And one mom named Erin, who went through one of my trainings, taught her two-year-old to say, "It's not my favorite." And she wrote back after a few weeks. She said, "Okay, two-year-old says it's not my favorite every day about at least one thing we serve." And she and her husband learned from me, like, we don't react emotionally or just kind of, I call it keeping your poker face. They would say, "Okay, it's not your favorite. No big deal." Almost every day, the two-year-old would end up eating the not favorite food. Because it's just like, you just need that sense of control.
Yes, the pressure's off.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we've got to let them have control where it should be. They should not control the food that is being served. That's you guys, grown-ups, right? That's the grown-up's job. But they do need to control the food going in their mouth.
And so
if we can relinquish that control to them, takes time. The older the kid, the more time it will take for them to believe that they actually have that control back. They need to hear you say, "You don't need to eat that. This is okay. It just needs to go on your plate," over and over, to kind of unlearn some of the things we do in our culture. Like, if you eat 3 bites of broccoli, you get your dessert, or I need you to clear your plate. We don't waste food. You know, we do a lot of things that are well-intentioned, but they don't work very well to help kids build a good relationship with food. And it's okay. You just throw those phrases out. You replace them. Kids are easily trainable, retrainable. Yes,
they are.
And they'll get used to the new system.
They definitely are. So you're saying if they have that little taster bite on their plate and they choose not to eat it, just clear the plate. Don't stress about it. Don't make it into a big deal.
Absolutely. Better yet, have them clear their own plate. First, for life skills and responsibility. But second, it's one more exposure if they have to push that off, that little bite off into the trash.
Okay. Wow. This is so great. Well, I have loved seeing my older boys grow up into their little adulting years. Aww. And they're cooking more. And just, it has been so rewarding for me to see them make really good nutritional choices and even to connect with when they're not feeling great, with, you know, some of the bad choices they might have made in their eating. But I have loved that part of life, just seeing them grow up and do the things that, like, you wonder when they're growing up if they're going to take that with them or not. As we start off the year, I know so many of us have great intentions for our family, and yet it's easy to feel overwhelmed by our family's schedules, or we might finish the week wishing we had been more intentional with our family time, right? Well, I know that managing a family is rewarding, but it's also hard work. So if you're ready to transform your family time and make meaningful connections every week, I'm excited to introduce you to Christian Parenting's Digital Family Meeting Guide. Every week, your family will gather to plan the week ahead, talk about the highs and lows of the week, and focus your hearts on the Lord. With 52 weekly guides and 12 monthly planning sheets, this resource makes it simple to organize your family life and deepen your relationships with each other and the Lord. The Family Meeting Guide includes weekly guides with Bible verses, family check-ins, and even a kids' choice section to keep things fun, monthly planning sheets to track goals, prayers, and appointments so everyone's on the same page. And don't worry, you'll receive everything in your inbox ready to print or pull up on your phone. Life gets busy, but staying connected doesn't have to be complicated. The Christian Parenting Family Meeting Guide helps you stay organized, grow closer, and focus on what matters most. Because you are a listener of this podcast, you can grab yours now for just $5. You guys, that is a bargain. Make this the year your family grows in faith and connection. Head over to cpgive.org, and for $5, you can get Christian Parenting's Family Meeting Guide. I know you're going to love it. Again, head over to cpgive.org today. For any families out there who are homeschooling or thinking about becoming homeschoolers, I'll bet you'd agree with me that there are a lot of options out there for homeschool curriculum related to English or history, even the arts. Yet, it's a lot harder to find a curriculum you can trust to teach your kids math and science, right? Math and science can intimidate the best homeschool parents. Well, let me tell you about our favorite math and science curriculum. Both can be found at the diveintomath.com website. You will find Shorman Math, which begins in the
fourth grade, as well as dive science classes beginning in seventh grade. Shorman's classes are self-paced using state-of-the-art e-learning systems featuring expert video instruction, interactive assignments with auto-grading and grade recording. I love that. Video solutions and Q&A support with Dr. Shorman, which my boys took full advantage of. If you hope your kids will grow up to love STEM classes and appreciate math and science, look no further. Head over to diveintomath.com. Check out everything they have to offer, including a placement chart to help you know where your child should begin.
Are there any suggestions you have for those with teenagers who maybe they're starting to see the countdown to the launch and maybe they don't have great, habits right now? What can we do partway through to course correct our teenagers?
With teens, you can do so much more talking. And with little kids, like, we're not going to do logic. We're just going to make these habits in our household. But I do think with teens, they're able to begin to understand how food makes them feel, right? So what do they love? They love soccer or theater or surfing with your boys. And I love the phrase food is fuel. Yeah. And so when we can talk to our teens, you know, they're learning the sciences. So what kind of food is going to be sufficient fuel for what you love to do? You know, what kind of foods are going to fuel that brain to memorize the monologue, to stand on stage for theater? What kind of foods are going to give you enough energy to surf for 3 hours without feeling like you need a soggy granola bar in your bathing suit? You know, not going to work. And so we can teach them about fat and protein and fiber and how those are the, you know, those are the long burning calories. And there's nothing wrong with carbs, but if you eat carbs by themselves, it's the quick burning stuff. Right. And you're going to run out of fuel and have blood sugar crashes. So I think like going the scientific route is a great idea. Mm-hmm. I actually recently told a mom who was asking a similar question, like, man, you know, my picky eater is like 17. Mm-hmm. And I said, all right, now that's really close to launch. I said, let's future cast with the 17-year-old. What is life going to be like when you're off in college a year or two from now and you're invited over to a friend's house for dinner? You're a poor college student. You don't want to buy dinner. And you go to this house and you're like, I don't eat any of this food.
Right.
Like, that's a little, it's a little embarrassing. So we want to talk to our kids, like, don't you want to be a grown-up someday?
That's right.
Like, grown-ups are able to eat food that maybe they don't love. Maybe we eat food that we don't love.
Sure.
Because it's what's available and it's what will nourish us or it's what mm-hmm. will fit in our budget, you know? So with teens, you can have such different, more nuanced conversations.
Yes. Yes.
Than you can with little kids. And so I like the, you know, the science fuel for the day. I kind of like the future casting.
When you find a girl you really like and you go over to her parents' house, that's what you want to be prepared for.
It's a good one. Yeah.
Yes. No, that's super helpful. Can I throw a couple scenarios at you that people sent in? Once again, if you're following me on Instagram, I love to gather some questions from real people with real situations. So can I toss a couple out there at you?
I love it. This is the best.
Okay. So we have a mom with a 5-year-old daughter, super picky. She says, basically what you just talked about, but let's get practical here. She says she will only eat a handful of foods and anything else that goes on her plate, she'll literally just starve. And the mom doesn't want her daughter to not eat. So if you feel like your kid is not going to eat anything, if you don't cave and give them what they want, how do we navigate that?
Mm. Well, I have a whole process that would take about an hour to explain, but two points. First, we've got to make sure that we're dialing in eating times, especially for little kids, because when they're home all day, and this applies to homeschoolers too, it's really easy to be grazing all day long. And then the child's coming to dinner and they have no appetite. Mm-hmm. They could care less what you put in front of them because it's not important. They're not hungry. And so step one for any process when you're trying to fix picky eating, I think, is to make sure that you've got time for the kid to build an appetite. So I recommend parents keep meals and snacks at least 90 minutes apart and only one snack between each set of meals, which might mean that the meals and snacks are 2 hours apart. That's okay. But if you're not starting with an appetite, everything else might be sabotaged. Sure. So you got to start with the appetite with some snack boundaries.
Makes sense.
And, you know, the ability to build that hunger. And then making sure that the child has choice within boundaries really will make a difference. I'm thinking of a mom in my picky eating challenge, Jessica, who said I was terrified. She was like terrified to follow my advice. She said, if I don't tell him to eat 3 cucumbers, he won't do it. And I said, but what if you try? What if you try? What if you try the poker face? What if you try? Because what I tell parents is, you know, you're in charge of what you serve. So you're going to serve, maybe you're serving pasta with sauce, strawberries, cucumbers, and a glass of milk. So that's what she, you know, Jessica served. And she was like, I have to tell him to eat the 3 cucumbers. She said, okay, I'm going to try the poker face. I'm going to try the division of responsibility where he gets to choose what he eats. And she just said, you know, I think she backed off and said, like, I want you to eat either some strawberries or some cucumbers or something like that. She gave him more choice. She pulled herself back. She was like shivering, like terrified. And she said, you know, not the first meal, but by the second meal she did that, he literally ate 3 cucumbers. Like he ate exactly the amount she would have forced him to eat. Mm-hmm. And I know that if that continues, once he really believes you don't have to eat that, this is a taster bite, you know, keeping the poker face, that he would begin to even eat more than what she forced
maybe
him to.
Maybe more than 3, so, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know it's terrifying. And we always want to make sure, for this mom of the 4-year-old, do make sure there's always something on the table that child does like.
Okay.
Right. Because you're right. We mean if they won't eat anything. Once we pull back on that pressure, good things happen. Give every change at least 3 days.
Give every change at least 3 days.
Be consistent.
Good tip. Okay, that's really good. And closely related to that one is the mom who said her child will say, I'm full after eating a couple bites, but then bedtime comes. I'm starving. What do you do about the bedtime hunger when you know they didn't eat something substantial at dinner?
I mean, I have no problem with that dinner coming back. I know that feels a little old school.
No, I like old school.
So, but I mean, if you're full at dinner and then you're starving, what kids are so smart. Monica, you know this. They're so darn smart. They're going to figure out the angle that's going to get them what they want. Yeah. Snacks are generally more fun than dinner. Mm-hmm. So what kid isn't going to try to figure out an angle to be like, oh, how can I get more snacks and less dinner? Right?
Yes.
So for a lot of families, keeping the meals and snacks 90 minutes to 2 hours apart means that bedtime snack does have to drop off the schedule. And that can, kids, again, they'll, when they expect that food, they know that dinner is optional. That is the last thing we want. We never want dinner to feel optional. So sometimes shifting the system so that they don't expect that is step one. And then, for this mom, I would just say, okay, well, let's put your plate in the fridge. And at any time throughout tonight, if you're still hungry, your options are all right here on your plate.
Sure. Okay. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. And we deal a lot with kids who say I'm full and then they want a dessert.
That's
too.
Yes.
Like
yes.
Same problem. So for me, I'm a big fan of toolbox phrases where we don't have to think at the end of the day when our brains are tired. So you just say it with no emotion whatsoever. You just say, oh, full means full. Oh, bummer.
Full means full. Okay.
Full means full.
Hey, yeah. Guys, I'm trying to take notes here. Full means full. I think my youngest son has tried to tell me he has 2 compartments in his stomach so he can be dinner full but still have room for dessert. So,
Do they have like a shared handbook? Because how many kids have said that same thing?
They're like, yes, they go to their message board to pull out another one. I love that.
Unbelievable.
So fun. Okay. And then you kind of touched on this, especially the carbohydrate issue. But one of the questions was the teenager who is, quote, addicted to carbs. They just want to eat carbs all day long and they don't want their meals. Quick thoughts on that.
It's tough. I'm kind of happy to hear the word addicted because that's an acknowledgement of a reality.
Okay.
That because we know, especially like the high sugar, the white flour with no fiber to slow that down, it really is turning on the dopamine circuits in their brain, right? We call it comfort food for a reason.
Yes. Yes.
it's comforting because it gets that serotonin and that dopamine flowing. And so there is that loop of addiction where it makes you feel good. It makes you feel better. We have emotional eaters for a reason because that food can make you feel better. So, I mean, how do you break the addiction? First, I would try to pair those carbs with some fat, fiber, and protein to see if you can begin to pull back on like the high blood sugar spike. Some kids need a straight detox, go on vacation and, you know, go camping or hiking or somewhere where you can be fully in charge of your food and just have zero sugar and see what happens and just sort of break that cycle. Wow. Cold turkey.
Yep. That makes sense.
But again, and thinking so about how they feel. Yeah.
Do you recommend a pantry clean out? Like keep, because I'm thinking teenagers are probably helping themselves to the chips and the junk food. Do you recommend just getting rid of stuff?
I recommend not buying things you don't want your kids to eat. Right. So I'm a baby steps. Yeah. I mean, I'm a baby steps person. So whenever someone says like a pantry clean out or, you know, a total overhaul of the way we eat, I'm like, it's probably not going to stick. Right. And so I'm a big fan of like, you know, if you're a mom and you're deciding that item and that item and that item in my pantry, I really don't want my kids to eat. Why am I buying it? Then just let it ride. That's the last bag. Internally, yes. You make that commitment. Sure. And when you see it and you want to grocery shop for it, you go, no.
Right.
We've already had our last bag or box or whatever of that. There's so much good food in the world. There's so much delicious food in the world. And I know Michael Pollan, the author of Food Rules, he says, if you make your own junk food, you can eat all you want. Mm. So you want potato chips? Wash them, peel them, slice a potato, right? Boil it in some healthy oils and then eat as much as you want. And it's so much work,
right?
It's such a long process that you would not eat as much
as you
would.
You'll appreciate what you do have, right?
Yeah.
And you'll probably develop a taste for that good, real food.
Yeah.
And see the difference between that and maybe what you used to have. It might take some time. But I think that's super helpful. I wanted to hear more about your thoughts on sitting down to dinner together since this is coming out early in the new year. Maybe just we'll touch on that briefly and then I'll let you go and we'll have you back again. But okay, another question that came in, and I know from talking to a lot of parents over time, this is not so unusual. A parent who has a couple kids with sensory processing disorder and said that the toughest thing is food texture, sometimes temperature. Do you have any tips for a mom dealing with sensory issues?
It is much more common now, and I mentioned that in my TEDx. So yes, absolutely. The great thing about food is that we can prepare it in so many different ways.
So true.
So, you know, depending on the texture preferences for the kid, if you think about a potato, you know, we can do mashed potatoes for kids who don't like crunchy things, although usually the texture versions are like against the like mushy, slimy stuff.
Right. Yes.
So how do we make a potato crispy? Well, potato chips, obviously, maybe not the best, but we can, you know, you can thin slice and like fry up those potatoes so that they're really crispy. And then you can experiment with dips and this and that. Like almost everything, maybe not everything, many, many foods can be made to that sort of more crispy texture. Even if you think of eggs, you know, if you're scrambling eggs, you can scramble it very slowly. You can add cottage cheese and then it's like light and fluffy and whatever. But for some kids, that's a total aversion. Mm-hmm. You can also fry or, you know, fry eggs or scramble eggs at like a pretty high temp, maybe add a little cheese so that you get like that crispy cheese bottom. And
Now
it's like, it has like substance. You could like pick it up like a sandwich almost and take a bite. Completely, completely different. So that's just thinking about it's not necessarily, hopefully you don't have to short order cook, right? We want to make sure that the whole family is eating the same food. I think that's really important to show family unity, but can you make little shifts so that everybody has some textures that they're okay with? The other thing to remember that most people don't know about sensory sensitivities is that all the senses work together, right? So this mom's looking and going, it's a texture thing. It's a temperature thing. But if that child happens to be overwhelmed by the fact that they have a scratchy tag at that moment, or that there's a lot of noise in the room, or that their feet are dangling, because, you know, so we have 8 senses actually, not just 5. And one of them is sort of that ability to be balanced.
Okay.
And so you picture a kid on an adult sized chair. What are their feet? Their feet are dangling and their brain is actually telling their body, you might fall, break your head and die. Not in words, but like our body, our body has this sense of instability and lack of safety. And so if you don't feel stable or safe at the table, you can't engage with food. If yes. your some of your senses are overwhelmed, your visual sense, your auditory sense, you might not be able to engage in food. So for parents with high sensory kids, we really want to think about some of that stuff. And you might need to get like a stool for their feet to sit on yeah. or something behind, between their back and the back of the chair so that they have the ability to sort of have that pressure there that an right. adult would, you know, their bum would be the back of the chair. Kids don't fit in adult chairs. Yes. So there are just some fascinating pieces when you start digging into the sensory systems where we can give our kids a better foundation to approach food, even if it's not having to do with the texture. But we can also alter the texture of foods where they yes. can eat a wide variety.
Sure.
And it's just sort of made to their liking. And that's okay. We all have preferences.
Yes. Yes. I think that's reasonable. Like finding that reasonable approach is yeah. really good. One more that I'm thinking of, because this comes up a lot, even in my own conversations with friends, for your approach to organic foods, how important is it that we feed our kids organic? And for the mom out there who's like, you know what, I can't afford to get everything organic. Do you have just some quick thoughts on how important or not important organic is? And is there somewhere we can find which foods really matter that they're organic?
That's a great question. We do not eat 100% organic at all in my house. And I think that's okay. Like, yes. Like, here's the deal, right? God made our bodies to be filters. We have a liver, we have kidney, like we have filters in our body where we can, mm-hmm. I always tell my kids, like we can filter out some junk.
Yes.
We really can. It's just, we can't filter out all the junk. So yes. how do we reduce?
Sure.
Right. So when I think about organics, I'm thinking about the foods that are maybe more highly sprayed.
Yes.
So we know that sometimes like corn, oats, and wheat can be more highly sprayed. So that might be something to consider. Yes. We know that like fruits and vegetables that are more porous, like berries, you can't like wash that off as well.
Sure.
And things, you know, so those are, you know, there's the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 that EWG puts out. And that's not a bad place to start. There's faults there too. One thing to consider is you're higher up on the food chain foods.
Okay.
So if I have a, you know, a hamburger that's coming from meat, and for a cow to be like organic versus not organic, we're talking about like the non-organic cow will have now eaten corn and soybeans and all sorts of stuff that was sprayed. And that's right. being more concentrated. The higher up the food chain you go, it's kind of like more concentrated toxins.
Okay.
Because they're eating so many pounds of food to make 1 pound of beef, right. if that makes sense.
Yes.
And actually, since I mentioned beef, when I think about the animals, it's far more important to me that the animals are living the way God intended them to live and eating what God created them to eat than necessarily organic. So if I had a choice between an organic burger from a farm with 3,000 cows and a grass-fed burger, I would pick the grass-fed every time because okay. I know if the cows are eating grass, the content of their fat is actually more protective for me. They're less likely to be diseased. Like there's so many benefits for animals eating what they're made to eat.
Yes.
And that so that's makes the priority.
Sense. That is so helpful. Yes.
And typically the grass isn't sprayed. So like right. they didn't pay for organic certification. You know, they might be eating a little bit of corn here. Well, fully grass-fed, they wouldn't be eating corn. That's the thing. Like
yes,
fully grass-fed, yes. you're not going to have very many pesticides anyway.
Okay, that's super helpful. I appreciate that. And again, all these notes will be over in show notes. So if you're out walking or driving, I've got you covered. Awesome. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Okay. Some thoughts on making a commitment to having meals together as a family. So many of us are busy. And again, no judgment. We get it. We love sports. We love activities. But what are some thoughts on things we can do to make those times we do sit down together more valuable?
That family dinner may be the most important part of our week. It really may, Monica. We know research says that eating dinner as a family has a stronger impact on academic success than time spent on homework, time spent on schoolwork. Okay. We know that research shows that strong family bonds, including family dinners, are probably the best impact on reducing risky behaviors for teenagers like alcohol abuse, depression, suicidal tendencies. It's a big deal. And it's also where kids learn to eat. Okay. I think one of our deficiencies in America is that we're tending to, you know, we talked about kids' meals at the very top of this interview. We tend to separate adults and kids eating. And so sometimes the kids are eating quickly because the adults are making their real meal, or the kids are eating quickly because they're going to an event. And when we sacrifice that time of being able to model what good eating tastes like and, right. or looks like, and model what, you know, approaching food with an attitude of curiosity looks like, we miss out on major teaching moments in the food sphere. Also, of course, family dinners are, that's where we build our family culture. That's where right. we lay down, that's where we connect and we laugh together and we lay down really the bonds that will keep us together forever. The good news is, because I know things can feel a little overwhelming, like, great, now I got to eat family dinner every night. All of the research-driven benefits start at two per week. So that's doable. It. Come it's on. So doable. And it's family meals, really. So there's 21 of those in a right? week. So yes. if you're homeschooling and your evenings are crazy, maybe breakfast or lunch mm-hmm. can be the family meal. And also, like I have a family of six. The older my kids get, the more they are out and about at night, right. you know, with events. Yeah. And so the harder it is to get six of us together. But if four of us are home, you better believe we're sitting down. Or sometimes we'll have a three early meal and a three eating the late meal. Any parent and child eating together
yes.
is a family dinner. You get that opportunity for bonding. You get the opportunity for modeling. So, you know, sometimes my oldest is 19. He'll come home at 9:30 or 10:30 mm-hmm. and I'll grab a bowl of ice cream with him.
Right.
right. Yes. Like if you are eating
and
together,
you're like, this is good parenting.
This is good parenting. That is exactly why right? I eat the ice cream. This it's very sacrificial of me.
Yes. Yes.
but yeah, so it's awesome. Just, you know, communing around food.
Sure. It is. And my I've mentioned before, my older boys, when I ask them, you know, what are some of your favorite memories you reflect on growing up? And they will say already, definitely sitting around the table, because every time we end up in some good conversation, typically nice. Ends up about theology, so a little politics, but we get into really good conversations that really have shaped them growing up. And that's just been a beautiful part of our experience. And I'm so thankful for it, mm-hmm. even if I didn't realize, you know, when we started how important it was. I think my parents raised me doing that. So I'm really grateful yeah. for that. Well, Katie, you talk about this. You have so much to offer about kids cooking, about kids eating, but you also talk about entrepreneurship for kids. You talk about raising critical thinkers. You've got a TED Talk we're going to link to about that. And you're also like an expert in something my husband just loves you for, which is sunscreen. My husband is the sunscreen police. You talk about that. So I'm going to put a whole bunch of links over in show notes. But if somebody wants to just jump on and find you and find out what you have to offer that might benefit their family right now, where can they go?
Well, come on over for kids cooking and picky eating to kidscookrealfood.com. And if you add /free knife on the end, we have our knife skills and safety class there, which is just a quick 10 minutes for ages 2 to teen, basic knife skills. Parents love it.
Yes.
The sunscreen and like healthy eating for adults is at kitchenstewardship.com, that our original OG blog.
Awesome. That I had. Love the OG blogs. All right. And you're on Instagram too, right?
Yep. Katie Kimball Kids Cook.
Perfect. Okay. All those links will be found in show notes. Katie, so much fun to talk to you. You inspire me. Appreciate all the work you do.
This was great. Thanks, Monica.
Aloha. All right, friends, I hope you were encouraged by everything that Katie and I chatted about there. And if you weren't able to take notes, no sweat. I got you covered. I've got some notes you will find over at monicaswanson.com/Katie-Kimball, K-I-M-B-A-L-L. I'll also link to where you can follow Katie and maybe get involved in some of the amazing resources that she offers. Also link to her TED Talks there, which are super good. You're going to love those. So be sure to check out show notes this week. And we've got so many good things coming up. The month of February is all love and marriage, even talking about dating and our kids. It is going to be really packed. And next week is an important one you don't want to miss, because we are going to talk about something you may or may not have ever known has a name, but the February slump is a real thing. The February slump is something that homeschool families talk about, but also if you're working, if your kids are in school, we all tend to face something around February that now has a name. It's the February slump. And we want to talk about how we can avoid it, how we can navigate our way through it, some strategies, some practical tips for how we can really pick ourselves and our kids back up so that we don't hit that slump and that we can have the best February possible. So I'm really excited about next week's conversation with my friend Leanne. I think you're going to find it super encouraging and practical. Okay, so spread the word about the podcast to your friends. You can always take a screenshot and share it to social media. If you're on Instagram, you can tag me at @MonicaSwanson_. I always love it when I see those. So thanks guys so much for being a part of this podcast community. I appreciate you. And I always love to hear from you. So if you have a topic recommendation, a guest recommendation, email me at aloha@monicaswanson.com. All right. God bless you guys. Have a wonderful rest of your week. And until next time, aloha.